Welcome to Tilt Talk Radio. Today we're going to be talking to a special guest, Elizabeth Burns Thompson from the Modern Ag Alliance. But with me today is Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilties out there.
And I'm Matt Brueger, both with Tilth Agronomy. All right, today we've got a special guest joining us on the podcast. Elizabeth Burns Thompson serves as the Executive Director of the Modern Ag Alliance, where she leads the Alliance's efforts to advocate for U.S. farmers' continued access to essential crop protection tools. Throughout her professional career, she has specialized in helping farmers and rural agricultural businesses sustain their voice in the political process. Her roots run deep in agriculture, having grown up on a family farm in eastern Iowa. She's held roles with the Iowa Farm Bureau and corn growers, as well as industry-leading biofuel manufacturers, farm cooperatives, and supporting innovative carbon management technology. So welcome, Elizabeth. Thanks for joining us today.
I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, we're excited to talk to you about all the work you've been doing with the Modern Ag Alliance. We've been talking the last month or so about mainly things going on in the field, and one of those things that are happening out in the field for our listeners is something that you're Modern Ag Alliance is really looking for, I guess, a solution to some challenges that we're facing out in the field. So for starters, I guess, for those of us who may not be as familiar with the Modern Ag Alliance, what is the Modern Ag Alliance?
Yeah, no, it is timely. It's spray season, right? I was up at the farm here just a few days ago. And people are going. So it is very timely for us to be talking about this. So appreciate you having me on as timely as this is. For those of your listeners that maybe haven't heard of us or seen some of our advertising and outreach work just yet, the Modern Ag Alliance was formed, I think we're a little over a year old now. I joined the Alliance in January, so hitting just past my 6 month with the coalition work so far. But our core objective really is to ensure continued access and availability of crop protection tools. And that has become kind of a term of art in the industry. I think most of your listeners know what I'm referring to when we're talking about that. But those are those critical chemistries, herbicides, insecticides, rodenticides, all that falls within kind of that regulatory scope within EPA of pesticides. So I would say also what sets the Modern Ag Alliance, a couple of things that set us apart from some of the other organizations that have worked in this space over time. We really are working at proactively playing some offense, as well as working more at the state level thus far on some of these proactive solutions. So we've seen, an incredible amount of threats to ag tech, especially in the chemistry sector, and that kind of growing over the last 5 to 10-ish years. And so I think, that broad coalition of our partners and our members, really came together and said, it's time to draw a line in the sand and begin to, like I said, play offense and ensure that we don't lose access to these tools. So I'm very proud to each and every day work on behalf of farmers and agribusiness entities really all across the country. Our members span everywhere from Hawaii to the East Coast, from Bismarck, North Dakota, down to Tallahassee, Florida, and everywhere in between. Fortunately, I've been able to travel to a lot of those places as well in the first few months on this job, and I know we'll have some opportunities to talk about what policy solutions we've worked on. But I think that's also another thing that makes me very proud of the organization is the cross-section that is represented both in commodities, everywhere from, the corn and soybeans that I grew up around, right, and the associations associated with that, to fruit and vegetable growers, to agribusiness, everywhere from East Coast to West Coast, and also from state associations all the way up to the national. So we also have partnerships with most of the major ag commodity groups and ag retailer groups out in DC every day. So we are working with a very broad cross section of agriculture.
Sounds complicated. So you said you've been with the Modern Ag Alliance since January, so about 6 months. What led you to this role? Why are you in the position you're in, what drives that?
Maybe I just love a good challenge. And I tee that up in that, you know, this really is a challenge, right? Pesticides, I think, your listeners know, are on the forefront. You don't have to go too far in the news clips to see that this is a conversation that is growing. That has already been taking place, but I think it's really moved kind of on high speed or fast tracked in the last, you know, 6 months or so. You know, in addition to what we've seen out in DC as it relates to some of the MAHA, you know, commission work and kind of the federal discussions about that, you know, we have also worked proactively, and there's a lot of conversations happening at the state level in state legislative chambers all across the country. You know, we worked on bills in about 12 states this legislative cycle, the state legislative cycle. Most states, and I can't say, you know, everyone falls in the same bucket, but most states do operate their state legislative kind of calendar in the early part of the year. That January to May time period is the most common. And so, you know, those have been really heavy travel months for us to get in front of state lawmakers, working with our partner organizations, again, along those lines of promoting legislative solutions related to crop protection tools.
Yeah, it's the crop protection arena right now has been, had a lot of things thrown at it. We've been talking on our podcast the last probably year or so off and on about some of the changes with EPA and the guidelines and FIFRA and all the things that are changing on the registration side. But now, you know, one of the reasons we reached out to you and your team was the glyphosate play here and what challenges are facing that right now seems to be, you might even call it a crisis, I guess, of what are we going to do if this goes away?
I think that's a fair, I think that's fair. You know, and we don't use the word crisis lightly, but I do think it's an appropriate term to stress the urgency, not only for what, you know, the chemistry glyphosate has seen, but what we anticipate. And when I say we, I mean the collective we as in the industry. That means the manufacturers, the retailers, the farmers that are using these products, the agricultural we sees this as a potential bellwether for, you know, what future chemistries have to face. And I think it might be worth maybe taking a pause at this point and kind of defining out what that crisis is or how we got here. And really it boils down to, you know, I think also a conversation that we're having in this country of what is science and scientific standards and what we depend upon to make those types of value judgments. But we really are sitting in a place where there has been, I'm going to use some air quotes, science of things that have been introduced into the marketplace by outside factors. In this case, if you back up to about 2015, 2017, right around in there, we saw a report come out of the IARC, or International Agency of Research on Cancer. It's an entity out of the WHO, so overseas. That called to doubt or called to question the carcinogenicity, so the potential of causing cancer of glyphosate. And it wasn't just glyphosate that was on their target list. They put glyphosate right alongside things like red meat, hot coffee, which I happen to be enjoying this morning, working the night shift or late work, amongst a number of other things. So there really is nothing that entity doesn't find causes a potential for cancer.
You just described farmers out spraying right now. They're probably spraying, you know, Roundup. They ate red meat for breakfast, maybe not for breakfast, but for sure for supper last night. And this morning they're drinking coffee, and lack of sleep or whatever you described, that's every custom applicator, farmer, anything right now. So yes, that does seem so broad that when everything's included, it makes it very tough to deal with that.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. And fortunately, too, that study or that research has been, you know, debunked time and time again. In addition to, you know, the United States isn't part of the WHO or the WHO anymore. You know, we can go down all of what that could or couldn't mean from political reasons. But to get back to, you know, what did that create? So that report comes out and you see you know, some political activity then in our country as a result of that. Specifically, I'm going to take the listeners over to the state of California, back to when the passage of their Prop 65. And the essence of Prop 65 was an initiative that said, if something is found or deemed to have a potential to cause cancer, it necessarily needed to be labeled as such. That was something that came out of the state of California. And that's where initially there were some conversations, and I shouldn't say conversations, there was litigation about, or lawsuits about whether or not a state can require a label on a product when there is no science in the United States that can support that. And that would fly contrary or conflict with our domestic process for labeling and registering products. Fortunately, the courts found in our favor, or as in agriculture's favor in that respect, that we can't have a, you know, patchwork of rules or requirements to a certain extent. However, that unleashed, and I don't use that word lightly, but truly unleashed a we're going to call plethora, a growing amount of litigations and lawsuits. Many of your listeners have probably seen them, right? All of the late night TV ads call this number and, you know, become part of a class action, you know, suit of some sort. Have you used this product? Yada, yada, yada. Those lawsuits are predicated, if nearly all of them are predicated on what is or is not present on the label. I think another key piece, because I think that's also a point of confusion, is that the litigation or the media that we see around glyphosate today is around the safety of the product. And that really isn't the core of what these lawsuits are about. The lawsuits in bulk have been around a claim that is deemed failure to warn. You know, I realize I have the benefit. I did also go to law school after I went to, I did a little bit of agronomy in college, a lot of ag business, and then I dipped my toe in law school. So I we're going to take your listeners to law school for just like the next 30 seconds. So a product liability 101, and at its core, what a manufacturer or a company has responsibilities to do really fall in three major buckets. And this applies to a pesticide manufacturer, a computer manufacturer, the person that manufactured this pen in my hand, or the chair that we're all sitting on, right? These are tenets that apply regardless of what you're making or building. You have a responsibility as a manufacturer to design a safe and effective product, right? So it needs to do what it's intended to do, and it needs to do so safely. If you don't do that as a manufacturer, there's a cause of action or a pathway to the courthouse, as we call it, for being made whole in that respect, right? The second leg of that stool, the second responsibility, is that you necessarily then need to manufacture according to those designs, right? So I can design a really safe chair, but if they don't put all the bolts and screws and pieces together appropriately and it falls apart and I fall down and I get injured, that is a completely separate cause of action or pathway to the courthouse, right?
Right.
There is a third leg of this stool or responsibility in that a manufacturer also must warn of known or inherent dangers of products, right? So that's why there is probably a sticker on the bottom of my computer chair right now. There's stickers and labels on almost everything that we buy, right? And so that is their responsibility. What we are talking about and the problems that we're working to solve is that just narrowly tailored on the third leg of that stool, what is or is not allowed to be part of a product label. And the crux of that is because the product label is so heavily regulated by the US EPA through the federal regulatory process.
Yeah, I think we're definitely familiar with the late night commercials you talked about. I'm never happier when I see the Boy Scouts of America come up rather than Gramoxone, glyphosate, some of the other ones that are out there, which sounds weird to say that I'm happy about that, but just to get a break from the other ones. And I think we've seen that play out in lawsuits for years out of that big state on the West Coast, especially when it comes to the use side of, you know, improper use and labeling and all that kind of stuff that you mentioned comes up in a lot of those lawsuits of like, well, yeah, guy was a gardener or something, was one I remember, and he doused himself in Roundup, but that was apparently the producer's fault of the chemical for not warning him not to take a shower in Roundup. But I definitely can see what you're saying from the standpoint of the stool that you mentioned, the three legs of how everything kind of plays together. But for, I think most of our listeners and for farmers in general, they're more concerned about the, you know, what is this going to do to the availability of my product, because I'm using it in a way that is totally different than a consumer is using this product. So I guess from your background and your time in the industry, what have you seen, I guess, that have farmers really been concerned about the, you know, the chronic disease side, which got brought up in the MAHA report recently, or, you know, is this more of a downstream consumer issue where they're more concerned about, well, are people going to buy our products if we still use this?
It's a fair question. So, you know, I have not been detailed into involved as the manufacturers that have been part of much of the litigation today, obviously. But you are right, a bulk of the litigation has been more in that home and garden sector. I do think, you know, as that conversation continues to build and grow, it's not only threats of availability of product, but also, I think, how do I want to word this? All of us here today, many of your listeners have the benefit of growing up in and around agriculture, right? We've watched a crop go in, we've watched a crop come out. Many of us also have the benefit of, you know, understanding the circle of life of being around livestock, right? There's so much of America that doesn't have that appreciation because they didn't have the benefit of seeing it firsthand. And so that you know, term of dousing, be it themselves or a crop in a particular chemistry, is what they have in their minds. But we know that's not practical. It's not cost effective. Right. No one would do that. you know, it flies in contrary to all that we've worked on precision, right? We optimization of these, of our machinery so that we, you know, are particularizing how efficient we are with tools. I think it's level setting just how we do things in modern agricultural production today to calm the hearts and minds and concerns of folks that just don't understand how agriculture works. And so I think that's a key piece of it, because at the end of the day, you know, the people that are writing the regulations, the people that are making decisions about the framework of which business operates within, and that's not just manufacturers, that's our farm businesses as well. You know, those folks need to understand ag because they're making the rules that we operate under. And so, and those rules dictate likely whether or not products and technologies can continue to move forward or even stay in the marketplace. And so that's where, I mentioned it before, glyphosate's incredibly important, right? I've got statistics here that say, you know, the acres that it's on, it is used so incredibly widely in large part because it's so successful. And on the cross, you know, section of crops all across the United States, and has done so for 50 plus years, right? And I think it's a great example of also something that has worked through our regulatory system here in the U.S. You know, it's been re-registered multiple times throughout its time on the market. So we need to ensure that we are protecting a process in this country that allows for technology and innovation, not only just the technologies and innovations that we have today, but if you are a company or you are an innovator looking at the environment that, you know, glyphosate has experienced in the last 10 years, you'd be pretty excited about putting a new chemistry through that with the level of uncertainty that exists, right? And we're talking about a process for a new chemistry that's, I think the latest data I saw was between 12 to 15 years from, you know, idea to product on a shelf. So we're talking about a generation almost, as well as, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. It's no small investment of time and resources. Now, if you've got to tack on $10 or $20 billion in litigation after the fact, that's a pretty uphill climb.
Yeah, just a few years ago, I remember we had some supply issues with glyphosate in particular, and Todd you probably remember how exactly how many years ago. I don't remember exactly how many years ago.
It was when we had all the spices, right around COVID time.
Yeah, you know, COVID, yeah. But, we did an episode on our podcast of, like, alternatives to roundup. What can we do instead? But the thing that we kept running into in that episode as we would talk through these, you know, different options is, well, you can do this, but the timings don't work out. Or you can't do it over the top of a growing crop. It has to be before the crop is out of the ground. And so it's, I don't think, a thing that we think about in terms of, like, well, you know, this was a short-term, we hoped at that time, and it turned out to be, you know, a short-term issue, but in the future we'll get Roundup back and things will, and glyphosate back, won't have these issues. But the way things are looking now with discussions in the industry, like, if we lose these crop protection tools, there's going to be consequences. And I think you mentioned some of them, but I guess, what do you see the landscape looking like if we do lose some of these products? Like, what do you think the next steps will be?
That's a very good question. So I hope that that's a world that we don't have to experience, and I'm working tirelessly
every day so that
we don't set that up. Because what I worry about, and I think what the industry worries about, is that if a domino falls, there are how many more behind that, right? So if we lose one chemistry, I think that only lights a fire under those that are spearheading the opposition to these tools to fight even more, to pull more of those tools out of the toolbox, because they don't just have a problem with glyphosate or Roundup. Their problem is with, or their objections are with, pesticides and chemistries as a whole in agriculture. And so, you know, it's glyphosate today, who knows what it is tomorrow or the next day. And that becomes, like I said, a bellwether, or, you know, it truly will light a fire under that opposition to work even harder.
That's a very scary thought from agronomists and our farmers that rely on this, say, tool of glyphosate. And like you say we lose that tool and we got to go to the next tool. There is not new tools becoming available very often. I mean, think of all the new, my brother-in-law is a tool guy for Snap-on tools. They got new tool. It blows me away, the new stuff they get to plug into cars or do this or do that. And they're getting new tools. And as an agronomist for, you know, doing this for 20 years, we've had we're getting new premixes. We're getting sort of what I call new herbicides, but new modes of action we're getting, you know, a couple in the last couple decades. So it is not something that if tools go away, we can easily fill that void with the next tool.
Nor is that a quick process, right? Like we talked about before, to get a new chemistry or mode of action through the regulatory, you know, approvals in this country is a decade at least. So, you know, these things don't turn on and off very quickly. And if we want to truly continue to spur innovation and bring, you know, new tools and technology, we need to have a process of certainty in this country for our manufacturers, for our retailers, and for our farmers to exist within. And I think, you know, if I could sum up what is kind of the crux of what we are sitting in right now and why, you know, the stress or the urgency behind this, we have the legal community and activists that have said, we are going to continue to sue you, manufacturers, agriculture, until you add these disclaimers or warnings or things on your label. On the other side of that coin, or, you know, insert rock and hard place here, you have the manufacturers and the regulators have said, EPA has said, there is no science to support adding these things to labels. And so we will not register products that have those disclaimers added. That would be deemed misbranding. So you have the ag community that, I mean, I rock in a hard place, call it what, untenable situation. That clarity is so important, because there is no way that you can acquiesce to both sides, right? We can't make the legal community happy, our activists that are working against us, and the regulator right now. There is just not a pathway to do that, but for the clarity that we are working towards and these legislative solutions that we have teed up both at the state level and the federal to try to, you know, provide a pathway forward.
Sure. Yeah. And it's definitely something that, you know, it seems, I think, from the perspective of our growers, and like we're professional label readers here as agronomists. We spend a lot of time reading
labels. This morning already, man, all the time.
And
labels.
Yeah, and we love how short they are because they're usually really easy to read. They're really short. It's not a problem at all to find information. They're all very similar. That's definitely not an issue either. But to get off that bandwagon. It's a complex thing, the label. Reading it, we want to make sure, you know, we're following label as, you know, whether you're a farmer spraying your own, using a co-op, or as agronomists making recommendations for these things. But, you know, it is a complex issue. And so you mentioned legislation. So what is this legislation doing for farmers, and who supports it? Who's besides the Modern Ag Alliance, I guess, who's the driver behind this? Who are you working with? I just asked you a lot of stuff right there. And so let's go back. I just verbal diarrhea there for a second. So, all right, let's start with the legislation. What is the legislation going to do for farmers? What kind of legislation are you supporting?
So like I teed up before, that rock and hard place scenario, it provides some finality for pathway forward. So it at its core just says that if a manufacturer has gone through the EPA labeling process, then they have been given or issued a label that is sufficient for warnings that are required, right? And when I talked a little bit before about kind of those responsibilities of manufacturers, those legs of the stool, those are a product of state law, right? So that's why we're going and working in the states, because it's necessary for us to make those clarifications as a product of state law. Even though at the end of the day, we're spending a lot of time explaining what sits within FIFRA, right? The Federal Insecticide, an acronym that I'm pretty sure most of your listeners are familiar with. It's something I spend a lot of time explaining to lawmakers. But what all is in the FIFRA process that EPA is looking at, and that encompasses what necessarily is evaluated as part of a label. And so it just basically clarifies how a manufacturer satisfies their duty to warn, because the label is so clearly and specifically outlined by the EPA. And that's why these bills are generally one page, very simple. Really? It's a simple solution to what has become a billion-dollar complex problem. We did get to kind of dig into where we worked on this last year. We had legislation that was considered everywhere from Idaho to North Carolina, Florida, North Dakota, all throughout the Midwest. But really proud to highlight our partners in North Dakota as well as Georgia, which is where legislation got across the finish line and was signed into law by the governor here, or the governors of those respective states here, just about a month ago. Our partners in those states were everything from your farm bureaus and your major commodity groups, right? And those commodities look a lot different in Bismarck, North Dakota than they do in Atlanta, Georgia, right? But everything from fruit and vegetables to the canolas and pulse crops and corn and soybean associations, our agribusiness partners, seed associations, it really, in both those states, a broad cross-section of agriculture came together in all of these jurisdictions, really, to highlight just how important clarity is for agriculture.
So have you found a lot of opposition in other places then, as far as, you know, you've mentioned the supporting ones, which aren't surprising, farm bureaus and different ag industry leaders, but I guess where is the opposition coming from besides, just the normal political stuff, I guess.
Yeah. So obviously in all of those areas, we have a cross section of the legal community, right? So some of the lawyers, which I can't knock them, right? They're the ones bringing much of these lawsuits. So they're going to fight for being able to continue to do those things. What has been interesting to me is some of the environmental community that has pushed back in this space, in large part because I feel like there's continues to be a disconnect about how important chemistries are to the adoption of critical conservation practices, right?
100%. It's very hard to do no-till or less tillage without these herbicidal tools. And so, yeah, you kind of have a very, it's a good thing you're talking about that, Elizabeth, that's very true, is you sort of maybe got a teaching moment there of explaining of how much more conservation we can apply, how much more soil we can save, a lot of other good things that are brought about because of the use of these herbicides.
And that's, it, to me, it just has been surprising that that has not been a more intuitive to more folks. So I think if there's a takeaway also for listeners here today is to not take even some of the most practical things like that for granted. So highlighting the fact that chemistry and conservation are hand in hand. But for one, you don't have the other, right? In many cases, or it has unlocked the opportunity for more producers to adopt more of those practices. Because that's an important piece for us to highlight, especially our more urban lawmakers that really are disconnected from you know, modern day. They just don't have the benefit of seeing it, and they may not represent constituencies or any footprint that has, you know, row crop agriculture represented. And but they are, you know, intrinsically worried about, you know, our natural resources and conservation. And so I think that's really an important talking point for anyone in the industry to be able to highlight. But I would say that those are, but back to your question, Matt, outside of, you know, the legal community and some of the environmental groups that have a problem with just pesticides in general. I'd say a good chunk of our opposition is folks that have a problem, not necessarily with what the bill is doing or the language of the legislation, but the fact that these chemistries are available at all, right? So these are the folks that just don't agree with chemistry in agriculture. And they use the opportunity that we're discussing this particular legislation as an opportunity to talk about their concerns or, you know, doubts around the technology itself.
Okay. Would you say from the standpoint of our listeners, so growers, producers, other folks in the industry, what's the best thing we can do, I guess, to help advocate for these products? You know, we've seen in agriculture a big push to tell your story and to get out there and be active. And unfortunately, I think that's been a learning curve for our audience of producers, is they're not always used to wanting to toot their own horn when it comes to these things or be on social media or other things that are popular. So what would you say is the best action they can take to help support these legislative efforts?
It's a good point, and I love that you use the term, you know, tell your story, because ever since I started in kind of the PR and government relations space in ag, we have been using those terms, right? 10, 15 years, tell your story. And it's still true today. We need more storytellers. I don't know that we need more people on Twitter, but alas, that's a conversation for another day. What I do think is the most important piece of telling stories is because they develop relationships. And so if you're not comfortable with going out and creating a platform to talk about, that's not always necessary, because at the end of the day, the goal of that is to develop relationships. So however it is that you can go about creating relationships, especially relationships with key decision makers, and that when I say that, I don't just mean like your secretary or director of ag or your, you know, county commissioner, you know, get to know your elected officials at the state level. Take time to get to know the elected officials and the staff members in your federal delegation, right? Your U.S. Senate and congressional offices. And so when there is a time, I won't say if, but when there is a point where it's important for your voice, that you're not working on, you know, having to say, hi, my name is so-and-so, here's why you should, you know, pay attention to my concerns because of, you know, I live in your district, develop that relationship up front. And you know, you've really done it if those members proactively reach out to you as a resource. What I used to tell some of the farmers when I was in more of the, you know, commodity group trade association space, I said, you know, you've really got there when an office or an elected official reaches out to you in relation to a question, because they went to you before they went to Google.
Right.
You're more trusted than Google. I mean, that, I think that's saying something, and that only happens if they know you and they trust you. And that doesn't require, a big fancy social media presence or, a TikTok account. That's just relationships. And so taking the time to build relationships so that there's a respect and an understanding of what you do and why you do it.
Elizabeth, what states right now are the next sort of closest ones to maybe passing it? What states do we got a lot of work to do in yet? And I'm sure there's some states that, I'm not saying it doesn't matter, but are maybe less important. But yeah, what are those next couple states that are really looking to pass this legislation, or it's close?
Sure. So right now, most of the states have wrapped up their state sessions for 2025. As of us recording this, the second week of June, there is still a provision that's alive, that's being considered in North Carolina. So we are continuing to work with, some of the Senate leaders there. It's part of their, Farm Act, provision in North Carolina. We are looking ahead at what outreach looks like for the 2026 cycle. There's a lot of time, a lot of time in politics between now and January of 2026. But I'd say we will have conversations with any state that is interested in having this conversation, especially, coordinating with our partner organizations on the ground in those places. So, I think we'll have a broad ranging effort come 2026. But to more precisely answer your question in the short run, what Modern Ag is really transitioning to throughout the summer and fall is even larger focus on some of the federal level efforts. And so what we talked about, Matt, along the lines of what is in these state level bills, there is something very similar that sits in a provision that Congress has had. It was introduced in the last Congress. You'll know that, we opened up a new Congress here in January with the election. And so that bill is likely to be reintroduced. It's the Ag Labeling Uniformity Act. It was actually part of the Farm Bill that the House considered last year. So we have great optimism that, the bipartisan support that saw last Congress will continue as it is reintroduced this Congress and likely on both sides of the House, or the House and the Senate, so both sides of chambers, and that would provide some clarity then, universally, right? Something that's done by Congress could help solve some of those solutions, all across the U.S. So we're going to continue to be working to promote that. So again, where I stress relationships with your federal delegation, incredibly important, because farmers and retailers and agribusiness will see action alerts to draw support around that particular provision here as we get into the summer. The other thing, obviously, is the conversations that are coming out of the administration, specifically around MAHA, or that Make America Healthy Again. We have some really strong concerns about what we saw in the first report that came out here about just a couple weeks ago, the attention that was drawn on pesticides specifically, and the questions around the safety and efficacy of these products. We are very concerned going into August, where we understand the second kind of step of that reporting will take place. And that report also being largely focused on tactics. So where the first step of that first report was focused mostly on identifying drivers or targets, the second phase of that, we understand their directive is to then, what do we do about it as a country? And so we are very concerned about, what could potentially be teed up as tactics to solve what they identified as drivers or problems, because specific chemistries were called out by name in that report. There was questions about review processes and the quality of the science. So we are working diligently alongside many of the national trade groups that are also prioritizing, conversations with members of Congress, with members of the administration. And again, these are folks that are not just in the ag space, right? We're cross-sectioning with our folks at Health and Human Services, right, that are drafting a bulk of this, the White House, EPA, obviously they're part of this. They're one of the leaders on the report too, and they have oversight over pesticide registrations, along with USDA. So there is a lot that will be happening and a lot of conversations that will only continue to grow, I would say, throughout the summer months.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the Farm Bill, because I always struggle to come up with reasons why we should be, I guess, happy we don't have a farm bill yet, but at least it's providing opportunities for more discussion on topics like this as they come up. And it's good to hear that there's traction there, I guess, to continue to support these types of products, and the opportunities are there. So from the standpoint of Modern Ag Alliance, what can our listeners do to, you know, find out more about what you're doing? Where can we get updates and find out information as these things are continuing? So obviously there's federal and state level things that are important to these folks.
So we have a wonderful website, modernagalliance.org, that's got an incredible amount of information, really a lot of state level information. So unique handouts, data points. Our team has commissioned quite a bit of research as well as some polling work. So, you know, it's important to have nationwide statistics and nationwide data points. But when we're working on things in you know, a specific state, it's really important and relevant for those pieces. So I would encourage folks to spend some time on our website and poke around. We also have a portal on that website that allows folks to very easily send a note to their member of Congress or their local delegation too. So we make it really easy. All you got to do is put your name and address into a form and the system sends that letter. It finds who your person is and it looks up their email address and it does all the heavy lifting for you. Caveat, I should say, as we talked about before, you should have those relationships anyway, right? Like we talked about earlier, but for those that may not, that's a really easy way to engage. We have social media pages. I'm sure many of your listeners have seen a bulk of our educational campaign. That's a key piece of what we work on too, is making sure that the general public is having a better understanding about what these tools are. And in addition, you know, organizations, obviously, if you are part of an organization that has an interest in this topic, we are always looking to add to our partners, right? We are stronger as a group than we are alone. And so if you're part of an entity that is not already on our list of partners, which is on that website as well, I would encourage you to reach out to have them join and become a formal part of our initiative.
I want to shout out to the website because it is a very good website. When we learned about it and went to it, it like you say, right away, it's got sort of that call to action of you can send something to your legislator. And I really like the tagline right away where it says "Control weeds, not farming." I think that's just it's great. It summarizes everything what you guys are trying to do there in four words, and it's quite simple. And the website's got, like you say, a lot of resources to learn about all kinds of stuff, you know, learn more background on some of the science and also learn about what is happening. So, yeah, I think that is a really good tool to push. As we go more to social media and all that stuff, this is a nice sort of spot where you actually can get a lot more information in a good, really one concise spot.
It is something that I think is underrated now. You know, we started with websites and then we moved to the instant information of, well, I can just go to Google, social media, you mentioned Twitter or X or whatever they call it these days. And now I find myself actually going to more websites, I think, again, just because there's less noise getting between you and the information when you go to a specific website and you can find information. So glad you guys...
Call me old school. I also enjoy, you know, person-to-person conversations. I think we lost some of that with the internet.
Oh, yeah.
So I love things like what we're doing here, or even coming out to field days and talking with producers or groups. So I'd let that be a plug of not only the online resources, but, you know, I love to get out and visit with folks. So if there's opportunities for other, you know, podcasts or, you know, opportunities to be part of a field day or a group event to explain a little bit more depth about this issue, I would also, you know, love the opportunity to share that message even further in person, because we do face-to-face.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Well, we thank you for taking the time today, Elizabeth, and joining us on the podcast. We are always looking to learn something, and we definitely learned a lot, I think, today as we've moved through. So thanks again for joining us.
It was wonderful to be here.
Yeah, thank you for all the insights. We really appreciate your time and everything. Anything you want to wrap up with, Elizabeth, or share at the end here?
just a reminder, the best way to get in touch with us is modernagalliance.org, and look forward to hearing from folks.
All right. Well, thank you again, Elizabeth, and thanks to all our listeners for listening. And as always, happy farming.